The Unruffled Beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Thursday, 10 p.m. It's time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling right here on listener-sponsored 90.1 KPFT Houston. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, professor of communication at the University of Houston downtown, along with Jacob Reiner, working the boards. You know, whether you're a storyteller or a story writer, you use symbols, words, motifs, gestures, eyes, voice, none of which meaning very much until they are navigated by the teller or writer and made into a story. But the skill set for a storyteller, regardless of medium, is so much more. It's that idea, the seed of discovery that determines the journey on which we will be taken, and it's the fusion of coherence and resonance that guides and engages us. All this takes time to simmer, and although humans are natural storytellers, most do not take the time to craft a tale in full. We're rushed or tormented by all the niceties required to shape the perfect story. Steven Spielberg, arguably one of the greatest storytellers of our time, wrote, "People have forgotten how to tell a story. Stories don't have a middle or an end anymore. They usually have a beginning that never stops beginning." Well, my guest knows how to construct a story and a feel for how authors form their tales. Benjamin Ryback is the marketing director of Brazos Bookstore here in Houston. He's editor-in-chief of the graduate-run fiction-friendly Sonora Review, and he is the author of Sadness, a novel forthcoming in 2016. He teaches creative writing for Imprint and Rightspace. It's a terrific site that supports writers and their work, and he taught writing at the University of Arizona, where he earned his MFA in creative writing. Ben, thanks for being here. It's good to see you.
Thanks for inviting me, Hank.
It's great. Ben hosted an amazing book signing for me back in July, and it really was a class act. I mean, people came other than my mother, and even she wasn't there, okay? She wasn't there. But he did a great job, and I really appreciate the incredible job that Brazos does. You know, those who never attended a book signing came up to me and said, you know, this was far nicer than I thought, and I warned them that most places really don't do it as well. They don't do it with the same kind of precision and style. How long have you been at Brazos?
I've been there a little over a year now.
How'd you earn the marketing director's gig?
You know, it's one of those funny things. I just sort of I wandered in one day and they needed somebody to do the events, and I got the job. I wish the story were a little better, but
that's okay. That's kind of romantic in a way. You know,
yes.
You're not looking for one. It's simple. It's easy. And there you go.
But right.
You're great at what you do. Tell us about Rightspace.
Well, Rightspace is a relatively new literary nonprofit here in town. It's great that Houston has a community that can support so many wonderful literary organizations, of course. And Rightspace focuses on genre fiction, which is a very popular form of writing. So they're doing well so far.
And I know you give a lot of advice to writers. You're a teacher, and mm-hmm. I know you give a lot of suggestions to fledgling young writers. But what comes to mind is the most common piece of advice that you might offer? Is there one that comes to mind?
Yeah, my joke one is that I tell people that if there's anything else that you even kind of want to do, go do that instead. I think when you start out writing, you get your heart broken pretty quickly,
yeah.
And then you know, like with anything in life, that just winds up strengthening
affair.
You.
It's a love affair. Yeah, no kidding. It's very metaphorical. It's so true. You know, I'm not much of a creative writer, but when I do, I find it isn't so much about writing what I know as much as it is writing about anything that I can imagine. And imagination is so critical, and most people don't think that imagination and writing are necessarily connected, as strange as that might sound, but with creative writing, that's everything. Now, in the story that you published a while back, Dad Stuff, mm-hmm. you seem to blend familiar with the inventive to create something moving, not unlike, in my opinion, Billy Crystal's 700 Sundays. It's a book that also translated very well into spoken form. And what inspired you to do that story?
It's the phrase "dad stuff," sitting around laughing with a friend about it one day. It's this phrase that's kind of simple and evocative. You know, if you say "where's your dad?" and your friend says, "well, he's out doing dad stuff," everybody sort of knows what that means somehow, right?
So it's just born out of banter.
It's born out of banter.
Perfect. Beautiful. Beautiful. Dad stuff. Tell us the story.
Sure thing. Two dads wander into the sunlight on their day off and do dad stuff. You've heard this one before. Let's say the first dad is my dad, and the second dad is your dad. Let's say our dads are friends because one dad's job intersected with the other dad's job. Let's say your dad is a cop and my dad is a building contractor. And when your dad pulled over my dad for driving a little drunk that time after my mom died, your dad looked at my dad's ring finger and saw the nervous way it tapped against the rubber sleeve steering wheel and decided to take pity. Later, when your dad and your mom decided to move out of their Mellon Street apartment and buy a house on Munjoy Hill, they bought one of my dad's houses. Let's say this is how we eventually met. Because my dad knew your dad and our family spent Independence Day together. And when we met each other, we were 18 and we started goofing around, play-acting like we were blind, leaving palm prints of green paint everywhere because we were closing our eyes and grasping at the walls to find our way. And our dads watched us and understood because dads always understand because dads have lived some days, let me tell you. So when our dads have their days off, they go out together and they do dad stuff. They don't have a lot of days off. Our dads work pretty hard, you see. Although your dad takes time each week to listen to Sundays with Sinatra on the radio, and my dad watches the movie Gettysburg on June 30th, July 1st, July 2nd, July 3rd, and July 4th, matching up each day of film with the actual day of fighting. Our dads don't have many friends other than one another, which works out well because when you and I decided to go out a few times, we knew that our dads wouldn't be concerned since they'd seen us for the last 2 years kind of falling in love and pressing fingers into each other's lips to silence voices at inopportune times to laugh. And now the only thing that concerns them is what we're going to do after the summer ends when we separate from one another for college, because our dads want stuff to be perfect. At least our dads think they do, even though my dad doesn't have a mom for me anymore and your dad has stopped inviting your mom to listen to Sundays with Sinatra each week. And she doesn't really care because she never liked listening to it anyway. Dads like local history. So when dads get together, they try to find interesting places to visit, like where the first governor of Maine lived, or the site of the state's first police academy. At the governor's house, dads can talk about the strength of the building's timbers, about the steadiness of the widow's walk, about the age of the bricks. At the police academy, dads can talk about all the stories of corruption back in the force in the 1930s, and how Chief Green moved the police academy because, as a superstitious man, the bad vibes surrounding years of illicit rookie behavior worried him. Dads learn stuff from other dads when they do dad stuff. Dads drink beers. Of course dads drink beers. Every day of dad stuff ends with a beer before the drive home. Dads talk about moms, like how they miss moms, some older version of moms, because moms are ghosts to dads, whether moms are dead or alive. Dads talk about other women. Dads ask other dads how long one has to wait after the death of a wife to start dating again. Dads ask other dads who aren't divorced to speculate on the nature of divorce, and dads always say the same old stuff. They say, don't live in pain, don't live like a caged animal, live like a man. They say this because they have a beer in them. And because the jukebox is playing an old Neil Young song they listened to in high school, and because the college girl waitress has her hair in a ponytail, a pencil tucked behind her ear, and no ring on her finger. When our dads do dad stuff in their homes, let's say we go with them because we can go upstairs while our dads are downstairs, and our dads probably know what's happening upstairs, probably know that we're lying on the floor together in whoever's bedroom with posters of bands we haven't listened to in 5 years on the wall, with a collage of photographs of friends and families on the door. Our dads have stuff to talk about downstairs. Of course, there is beer and Cape Cod potato chips, and since dads like sports, there is probably sports too. Let's say there is sports. Let's say one dad tells the other dad that he's building a house for some young married woman with a bulldog tattoo and a septum piercing, and that this girl seems so sweet and messed up by her marriage, and that she reminds him of that brief midlife crisis his wife started to go through right before her plane crash and ended her life. Let's say the other dad, thinking of his own wife and how late she started coming home at night, how she bought some new clothes the other day for the first time in 10 years, how she's become far more sedulous about her morning jogs. Let's say the other dad, thinking about all of this, tells the first dad that he should maybe be a little grateful that the plane went down, because sometimes that's the only way life can be stopped, and misery would have danced in even if his wife had gone on living. Let's say this isn't what my dad wants to hear right now. So he gets kind of mad, and our dads don't do dad stuff together for the next month. Good thing we hadn't taken each other's shirts off yet, lying on the floor, because my dad comes upstairs and opens the door like he lives there and says it's time to leave, still fiery because of the way the downstairs dad talk turned. Good thing for this, let's say, because all the dad stuff in the world cannot overcome the sight of a son and daughter rolling on the floor, laughing like they live in a place where it never snows, a place that misery will never touch. Now, here comes the tricky part. Let's say that one of us dies. Let's say that I die, because at the end of the summer I have an accident on the highway. My tire blows out. Nothing I could have done about it, except maybe take the car for that checkup like my dad kept nagging about. Let's say, because it's not too big a city, that your dad arrives at the scene of the accident and barely recognizes me, but recognizes the car and calls my dad and wishes, Jesus Christ, wishes a beer sat between them while they had this conversation. Let's say that the first thought in my dad's mind when he hears the news is that he's not a dad anymore, that he has no dad stuff left to do. When he goes to work the next day, like he has to, because he works all the time, remember, he asks the young wife whose house he's building if she plans on having kids. And she chews the inside of her mouth and tells him she doesn't plan on having kids because kids are too much trouble. Let's say that at the funeral, when you hide your face in your dad's shoulder and your mom puts her arm around the two of you, you look to my dad like a package, like something wrapped and shiny. And my dad doesn't feel like talking about local history or grabbing beers anymore. And he barely feels like working because he knows that he only has a few weeks left of construction to do on the young wife's house. And after that, he has no building prospects lined up because who wants to build a house the way the economy stands now? My dad has no stuff left to do. Except go to sleep early. Except try to remember if your dad's blazer at the funeral was black or blue. And wonder about what kind of man wears a blue blazer to a funeral. One dad wanders into the sunlight with somebody who isn't a dad. Let's say the man who is not a dad is out of work, because he is. And that the dad is in his police uniform, his lunch break. So he won't be grabbing a beer, but we'll have a lobster roll and fries, thank you. Let's say the man who is not a dad anymore asks the man who is still a dad about his daughter, how she's getting on at college. And the dad says that she's getting on at college just fine, and that she kind of has a boyfriend, too. And the dad is eating a few too many fries as he talks about this, like he's trying to fill his mouth with something other than the words he speaks. And this doesn't sit right, of course, with the man who is no longer a dad, who thinks, frankly, that not enough time has passed, that there should be some reverence, damn it, that a little local history should matter to the dad's daughter. Because the man thinks about the dad stuff he could have done. He thinks about the house he built for the septum-pierced young wife and how she stood in the kitchen and got a little too close to him and told him in a moment of unexpected tenderness that she didn't think she loved her husband anymore. The man could have had something right then, you bet your money on it. But because a little local history mattered to him, he backed off. But your dad politely reminds the man who used to be my dad that my tragedy on the highway did not break up a marriage, but simply broke up something that was going to break up anyway when summer ended, when the two of us split for college. Of course your dad encouraged you to move on, said that this is not love, no, not it at all, and that late nights away from home are not love, and that 15-year marriages are not love, and that 90-degree summer days and lying on bedroom floors are not love. The man who used to be my dad cannot exactly disagree with this because he hasn't known love that didn't stop in a plane crash or a car accident. Love that didn't burn out like a sparkler, quickly lighting up the night and then going out. Going out, probably, the man who used to be my dad has to admit, at the exact moment the child holding the sparkler began to get bored with the light, bored with the tiny explosions. But let's not feel too bad for the man who used to be my dad, because the waitress with the ponytail and the pencil behind her ears calls him sweetheart when she brings out the check. And because she looks back over her shoulder at him as she dances into the kitchen. And because the man who used to be my dad knows his hands aren't too worn to still build a house. And because he finally remembers that your dad wore a black blazer at the funeral, not a blue one. Mostly, let's not feel bad for this man, because he knows he's right, and he is right, believe me. Because you've been gone for only 2 months, and already there is somebody new. Already the memory of me is a melted ice cube in the glass of vodka cranberry you're always holding at those parties. So while we're on the subject of dads, let's say my dad loves me, even the memory, more than you ever did. Let's say were I still alive, my dad could kick your dad's ass, which is the oldest insult in the book.
Well, you know, when I read that, Ben, what struck me were the amount of emotional shifts. You know, it was just amazing. And now you framed a lot of it around death. Why is that?
Because sometimes death is the only way to get a reader's attention.
Yeah. I never thought of it that way. That's amazing. Are you close with your dad? Is your dad at all an impetus behind any of this?
My dad's an illiterate farmer from Oconomowoc, Wisconsin.
No kidding.
No, I'm kidding. He's actually a police officer from Portland, Maine.
Same thing. No, I just insulted all the law enforcement people in the world.
I am close with my father. Yes, he reads my work and he enjoys it.
What's the message here? There are a lot of great messages, but you know, you really did synthesize an awful lot of emotional shifts, and it was terribly poignant. And you're right, I guess, you know, the idea of using death to get people's attention is, I don't know how I feel about that, but you're absolutely right. But what's the thread? What's the idea? What do you want us to know in the story?
That life is a strange and complicated and vibrant thing, I suppose. You know, I joke a little bit about the death. I think Flannery O'Connor said something to that degree, that sometimes death is the only way to get someone's attention. But yeah, I think, you know, I like stories to reflect a range of emotions in life.
Yeah. How long did it take you to write that?
Well, that's funny about this story. This story took me an hour to write. I wrote it.
Are you kidding me?
I wrote it very early in my time in the MFA program. This is more or less a first draft of the story.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I thought, well, this writing thing's easy. And then it has never been that easy again for me in my life.
Wow, that's amazing. So. Now, I'm going to ask you a question and think about it, because we're going to talk about it in a few minutes.
Sure.
Where do you start? You start with picture boards. You start with words. You start with mapping, brainstorming. Mm-hmm. I want to know how you start writing.
Sure.
I'm Hank Rubicek with Jacob Reiner, and you are listening to So What's Your Story with guest storyteller Ben Ryback on listener-sponsored 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, 90.3 in Livingston. Halloween is around the corner. Oh, please. Okay, let's see. Where's that sound? Oh, please. Okay. It's all in timing. I'll shut up right now. Halloween's around the corner, and leave it to our sponsor and best darn storytelling group in the state, the Houston Storytellers Guild, to harness a heap of haunting tales this Saturday, October 24th, and Jacob is going to tell you all about it. Jake?
We're talking about Skyline Screamers. There we go.
Okay, go ahead.
This Saturday, it'll be from 7 to 9 p.m., at Merriman Park, located at 1802 Heights Boulevard. Admission is absolutely free. Bring your lawn chairs, blankets, and a place to hide, because you'll be afraid. Very afraid. But also, have more fun than the law will allow.
Thank you, Jake. Afraid, yes, but it is child-friendly. So Jake's claim is true, but I promise the fear factor is no more than a 5 on a 10-point scale. But the Guild is a group that rates 12 on a 10-point scale, and Jacob will tell us when and where they meet.
Well, their monthly story swaps are on the third Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m., located at the Multi-Service Center at 1475 West Gray. Check out all the events sponsored by the Guild and information about becoming a member of the Guild at www.houstonstorytellers.org.
Super. Next week, my guest is a colleague, Dr. Paul Mandel. He is an assistant professor of Spanish at UHD. His stories will be in English, believe me. But he was on the faculty at the University of Wyoming in 1998 when Matthew Shepard was beaten and left to die. And it promises, and I do mean promises, to be a very poignant evening and also a little bit of fun, because we're going to talk about our favorite Halloween memories. And November 6th will be stories. Actually, that's wrong. November 5th, excuse me. November 5th will be stories from veterans on So What's Your Story. And Jacob, tell us a little bit about this, please. You're kind of in charge of it.
Yes, sir. We've got the essays in from the contest. We are narrowing them down. So very soon we will have our final three guests being able to tell their experience and what they want, as we call them, civilians to know about veterans.
And they're each going to have a story that's about 3 minutes long, about
500
words tops. Very
yes,
good.
Sir.
We're going to have them here, and we're going to talk about it, and we're looking forward to that. We really are. That will be terrific. Before we talk about your upcoming novel, talk to us about how you go about writing.
I mean, of course, it depends. That's the easy answer, right? But but generally speaking,
this one. How'd you start writing this one?
This one in particular. Well, as I mentioned, you know, it was sort of laughing about the phrase "dad stuff." I think that I usually have some vague direction in mind when I'm writing. It might be an end. I sort of had the end in mind at the beginning when I started writing the story. That last kind of cheesy joke that caps it off.
Right.
And then if that's what I have, then I try to divert myself and surprise myself. I remember writing the story and being very surprised when I killed myself off midway
you,
through it.
You sit in the kitchen with a pot of coffee and a pen and a paper. You sit in front of the computer. What do you do? I'm fascinated by that. And that's important, actually, that whole process. It's a whole thing. So what do you do?
I sit in front of the computer a lot of the time because I can type fast, but there are times when I have trouble getting started, and for some reason, whenever I have trouble getting started, I always sit down with the pen and paper.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I ask that for good reasons, because writing is an extraordinarily wonderful process. It's a wonderful process. It's cognitive. It's affective. You feel things. You want to say things. You struggle with things. And sometimes the kind of instruments that you use in writing, at least that's what I find, is really very critical. You know, you have to have the right pen, the right paper. You have to be in front of the computer. You have to be in a certain room. Sometimes I work best in the kitchen because I'm writing about kitchen stuff. It has nothing to do with the kitchen. I just feel that what I'm writing has to be articulated when I'm sitting in the kitchen. I know that sounds crazy.
We writers are a very superstitious group.
Yeah, we really are. But you're really a writer. Me, I just play with it a little bit, but you are a writer. There's no question about it. Your upcoming novel, Sadness. Give us a little bit of a teaser.
It's about the ecstasy of film and the fear of failure.
Ecstasy of failure. Tell us a little bit more.
In a way, it's about it's about storytelling. It's about falling into falling into a great movie, and then you know.
And when can we expect this? Is coming out? This is coming out when?
This will come out next June.
Okay, great. Now, this is something that you just shared with us. This dad stuff. It was written, but it was remarkably conversational, right? And you said to me, this is conversational. And I think that's your style. And oral and written communication are incredibly different. They really are. You know, you can give me something in writing. I have no idea what you're talking about. I can shove it in a drawer, read it every once in a while, and figure out maybe what you're trying to say. But when you articulate something in spoken form, you can only say it once. When you say it again, it's going to change, right? Mm-hmm. So in your own mind, what are some of the differences between written and oral communication?
Did
you fuse them well? I mean, you merged them so well.
Well, you know, before I came here, I went back through the story again, and I did find myself changing things to make them perhaps a little more oral in places that were.
And what did you do? How did you change them to make them more oral?
I tried to make them a little more concrete. I think I have a tendency to get a little flowery with my language. Mm-hmm. That is not terribly conducive to oral storytelling. I think oral storytelling should be fast, and it should sound like your buddy sitting down next to you at the bar and saying, here's what happened, and can you believe that she did this, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and of course, doing what you do at Brazos, I'm leading in a very logical direction here. I think I hope I'm not one of the people to whom I'm about to refer, but to follow up, you find yourself hosting some really good writers. I know that you do, some great writers at Brazos, and many of them, because I've been there and you know that this is true, many of them really can't effectively present anything about their writing without mentioning names. what are some examples of that? Like, give us an example of somebody who's written something in particular and what happens when he or she tries to articulate it in spoken form?
You know, most of the time, I think they do pretty well. I'm actually amazed by how well most writers do talking about their work or reading it. If you think about what writing is, right, you're basically sitting alone for 5 or 10 years if you're working on a novel, right? Mm-hmm. And you're not getting a lot of sun and you're not talking to a lot of people.
Well, Ben, we're sitting alone right about now because I'm not sure anybody's listening. Are you listening at least? Okay, fine. You know, Jake was falling asleep. I just wanted we have like a listening audience of four. Yeah, but no. But yeah, we're sitting alone right now. But you're sitting alone.
Yeah.
Okay, and...
And then you and then when you finish the thing, you suddenly have to go out and you have to shake people's hands and squint into the sunlight and try to make sense of the stuff. I think what's really the best writers at reading their work, they give you the sense that they are thinking as they're reading the work, right. And you're hearing their thoughts.
I love that.
When a good writer reads his or her work badly, usually it seems like it's shyness to me, and that's an inability to communicate what that energy is on the page.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, because I agree. I think that a person who is able to tell a story well gives the impression that the story is unfolding as they tell it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they sequence it spontaneously, mm-hmm. and somehow it really feels like a natural evolution of the soul, almost. It really is pretty spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
You are listening to guest storyteller Benjamin Rybak on KPFT, So What's Your Story? I'm your host, Hank Rubicek. Now, Brass's Bookstore is a vintage bookstore, Ben, in the best sense of the word, and it's a cozy, welcoming, charming place that you'd expect from this really wonderful Houston institution. And those of you who've never been there, shame, shame, everybody will know your name. Tell us about some upcoming events at Brass's and how listeners can get on a mailing list and anything else you want to tell us about this really unparalleled shop.
Well, on Monday, we're hosting Richard Ford, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. On Halloween, we'll be doing an Alice in Wonderland-themed costume party.
Beautiful, beautiful.
We're also going to be doing events with Orhan Pamuk and Mary Gateskill coming up. We've got, you know, we'll have a lot of great gift ideas and books on display going into the holidays, and I would urge people to just visit us online, BrazosBookstore.com.
Right, absolutely. Beautiful. Thank you. And I know this is corporate-free, but I'm here to tell you right now, if you don't get some great gift cards, you don't get stuff at Brazos for the bookstore, you really are doing yourself a tremendous disservice. Tonight, we are about creative storytelling in written form. Borrowing scraps of thoughts from those far wiser than I asked my pen, what does the world look like, feel like? And then I wait for a response. Who was the storyteller in your home growing up?
I think my dad, dad had the best stories.
Yeah.
He would tell a story about, you know, something strange that happened to him at a sandwich shop for lunch, but he would start the story with, you know, some really horrible detail of his police work that he was working on.
It always seemed like he was... point of entry.
He was telling the wrong story sometimes.
Yeah. Point of entry. That's right. Now, if people say, listen, I can never tell a story about myself, I can't write, what would you say to them?
I would say, have you ever really tried?
Yeah, most people haven't. They're afraid to. And they are afraid of writing. They are. But, you know, you don't have to have stuff published. You don't have to worry about getting anything done. You really don't. Yeah. It's writing and speaking are inextricably related. And our ability to communicate is pathetically spiraling down, for lack of another label. I have other words that I can say, but let's just leave it at that. Ben, thank you so much. Ben Rybak, for stressing to us that creative writers take themselves to places they'd never been before. And we, the readers, the listeners, the ones absorbed with all of our senses, reap the benefits of this thing we call magic. Best of luck with sadness, Ben, and get ready for the masses heading for Brazos. One smart holiday gift destination to be sure. Scooter is up next with The Inner Side to complete the backside of this Power Hour on KPFT. You make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us every Thursday at 10 p.m. for So What's Your Story and ease into the weekend right. You keep loving a great story, and I'm going to keep bringing them to you. Be good to each other. I'm Dr. Hank, reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Time for Blues for Food. feeding Houston for 26 years. Over 12 hours of world-class blues benefiting the Houston Food Bank. It's all happening at the Shakespeare Pub on Sunday, November the 8th. Your admission is any non-perishable food item or cash. Includes music, genuine Texas barbecue, raffles, silent auctions, and lots of fun. It's all happening at the Shakespeare Pub Sunday, November the 8th. With live music by Bourbon Street, Mighty Ork and the Unusuals, Annette Matois and the Guys, Aaron James Band with Chris Ruist, Larry Garner, Sonny Boy Terry Band, Jimmy Louisiana Dotson, Rich Del Grosso, Trudy Lynn, the Steve Crace Band, the Zydeco Dots, Dave Neveling and the Blues Cats, Rick Lee and the Night Owls, topped off by Sparetime Murray's world-famous blues jam. Music goes